Our son Joshua loves fishing, and that has nothing to do with me. It's because our friend Bill is teaching him how to fish. If it were up to me, he wouldn't know how to do it, and he wouldn't love it. I don't particularly enjoy fishing. I don't like being out in the water for long periods of time wondering if or when the fish are going to bite. I do love that moment when they do bite and you reel them in, but as soon as I get the fish in, they're slimy, they're scaly, they're stinky, and that whole process from going from the hook to the plate, I would rather have nothing to do with it. So thank you, Bill, for teaching Joshua how to fish. I'm so glad that you are doing that and not me. Most of the people who fish for fun. They enjoy the sport of it, and it's nice to eat some of the fish that you caught. But there are some people who actually use fishing as an occupation. Their livelihood comes from fishing. And even some of the best fishermen sometimes have bad days where they will spend hours and hours out on the water and they will come home with nothing. Jesus's disciples, many of them, were fishermen, and they depended on fishing in order for them to live. They spent the years before Jesus called them to follow him on the water, on the Sea of Galilee, making a living in boats and nets and fish. And then when Jesus called them to follow them, they left their nets behind. But after they followed Jesus for 3 years and he was crucified, it seemed like that had kind of come to an end. He rose from the dead, he appeared to them on that Sunday, and then again a week later, but they weren't exactly sure when he was going to show up or what exactly they were supposed to do. And so they decided that they were going to go fishing. It was Simon Peter's idea. He announced to the other disciples he was going fishing, and they went along with him. It's not clear if he's leaving Jesus and the ministry now to go back to his old livelihood, or if he's just bored, he's not sure what to do, or if he needs to get some food for his family and maybe have something to sell. What we do know in John 21 is that when the disciples go fishing, they come back empty-handed. They knew the Sea of Galilee, they had fished it for years, they knew where the best spots were, and they knew when the best time was to fish. It was at night when the seas were calm. But this particular night, they kept casting their nets in the lake and then pulling them up and finding them empty. Then as the sun begins to come up, they see someone walking along the shore. And this person calls out, "Hey, lads, do you have any fish?" They yell back, "No." And then this person gives them some unsolicited fishing advice. And if there's anything I think professional fishermen love, it's unsolicited advice. Fishermen I know love to share their secret fishing spots. But for some reason, when this person gives them the advice to throw their nets over the right side of the boat, they follow him. And when they do that, and they go to pull the nets up, they are so incredibly full of fish that they can't even pull them into the boat. As this is happening, the disciple who's writing the gospel, the one who Jesus loves, turns to Peter and he says in verse 7, "It is the Lord." When Peter hears this, he throws on his robe and he jumps over the side of the boat and he splashes his way into shore. They weren't actually that far out, but Peter was so excited to see the Lord that he just couldn't wait. He had to get in as fast as possible. The rest of the disciples are left, the net hanging off the side of the boat, have to get the boat and the net back into shore. But they realized that this was the Lord. This was the same Jesus that they had followed, that they had seen crucified, or at least John had seen crucified, and that had now risen from the dead. And there he was on the shore of the Sea of Galilee, providing for them an abundance of fish. Earlier in John chapter 6, They were also along the Sea of Galilee. And in both places, John calls it the Sea of Tiberias, but explains that that's the another name for the Sea of Galilee. And in both places, Jesus provides this abundant feast. In John 6, he feeds 5,000 people. In John chapter 21, he feeds his six disciples with more than they could possibly eat. What Jesus is doing is that he is revealing once again that he is God. In everything that he does and everything that he says, Jesus is revealing that he is God, the God who was crucified and the God who rose again. But he's also revealing something else about himself, something that he did throughout his life and now continues to do after his resurrection, that he is the one who serves. When Peter gets ashore and then the rest of the disciples do, Jesus already has a charcoal fire going. And on that charcoal fire, he's got some fish and he's got some bread. He invites them to bring the catch that they have caught, and Peter himself somehow summons the superhuman strength to pull the net in by himself. But Jesus didn't actually need that. He already had enough bread and enough fish for them. And now what Jesus does is he takes that bread and that fish and he serves it to the disciples. What he is revealing to them is that he is also the God who serves. John tells us that they knew it was him, but they were afraid to ask. They knew it was him, but they were afraid to ask. It's because it's clearly the Lord, but he's acting in a way that they weren't exactly expecting. Even though he had served them all of his life and he continued to serve them now, it still seems strange to them that he was the God who served. The previous times when he had appeared, they had bowed down and worshiped him, and Thomas had confessed, "My Lord and my God." But now, he was humbling himself, and he was taking care of them. This was the same God that had wrapped a towel around his waist and had washed their feet. The same God that had put now was wearing an apron and acting as a server, making sure that they had a good, hearty breakfast. You've heard of the Last Supper before. Well, this is the story of the Last Breakfast. What Jesus is displaying is that no matter where they go, no matter what they do, he will always be with them, providing exactly what they need, providing an abundance for them. And that's a message for us as well. That no matter where we go, no matter what we do, Jesus continues to be with us as the holy God who bows down and who serves his followers. We are right now being served by Jesus. We don't worship a God that is only up in the heavens, distant from us, who one day every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that he is Lord. We serve a God that we can look down to because he has knelt down and washed our feet. He has provided us food to eat. This is our God, the God who serves us. And we become like the God that we worship. Whatever idea we have of God, we end up becoming, at least in some degree, like that idea. So if you have this idea that God is holy, you too will become more holy. If you have an idea of a God that is also gracious and serving, you will become more of a servant. And this service has a dramatic effect on all of Jesus' disciples. But in this story, it begins to focus on Peter. And it was that way from the beginning of the story. It mentioned a charcoal fire. A charcoal fire would have a particular smell to it. And our sense of smell is the sense that is most closely connected to our memory. When you walk into a house and you smell that house, and if it happens to smell like your grandma's house, you suddenly are flooded with memories of your grandma. You smell someone's cologne or perfume that someone that you are close to wore at some point in their life, you suddenly have 1,000 memories of that person. And fire seems to have a particular smell that inspires and sparks memories. In the winter, someone lights their fireplace for the first time, just when there's the first chill in the air. You walk outside, you smell that smoke, and suddenly you have all of these feelings and memories about winter and Christmas. And then in the summer, someone lights their grill for the first time, and it fills up the entire neighborhood. You're suddenly remembering what summer is like. And so when Jesus is burning this charcoal fire, Peter has a very specific memory. The only other time a charcoal fire is mentioned is in John chapter 18, when Peter denies Jesus. He had sworn to Jesus that he was going to follow him, that he was going to lay down his life for him, that no matter what the others did, he himself would follow him to death. Jesus had told him, "No, before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times." When Peter was led into the court of Caiaphas, the high priest, that was the first time a servant girl asked him, "Are you not one of his disciples?" And he denied Jesus. Then he found himself warming himself over a charcoal fire. And twice over that fire, he was asked if he was a disciple. And two times he denied, the second and third time he denied Jesus. And so Jesus is reminding Peter of that time when he denied him. But he's going to redeem that experience before another charcoal fire, this time by asking Peter if he loves him. He's going to ask him three times, "Peter, do you love me?" And each time Peter is going to say, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He repeats it again, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." And then he asks him a third time, "Simon, son of John, do you love me?" And he says to him, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." This time, instead of denying Jesus three times, Peter is affirming his love for Jesus. But his confidence is no longer in himself, in his own willpower and determination. His confidence is in Jesus. It's not, "Jesus, I'm going to do it." It's, "Jesus, you know. You know. Jesus, you know everything." Peter is realizing that he is utterly dependent upon Jesus in order to follow him. Jesus uses these questions to reveal a new humble attitude in Peter. And he tells Peter, when every time Peter says he loves him, he tells Peter that he's going to feed his sheep. We know that Peter understood this because in Peter's own epistle, in 1 Peter chapter 5, he reveals that this has become his life mission. "So exhort the elders among you, as a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, as well as a partaker in the glory that is going to be revealed. Shepherd the flock of God that is among you, exercising oversight not under compulsion, but willingly, as God would have you, not for shameful gain, but eagerly, not domineering over those in your charge, but being examples to the flock." Peter realizes that these are not his sheep, these are Jesus' sheep, and that he is not to rule over them with an iron fist, but instead he is to serve them just as Jesus has served him. But Jesus reveals this new attitude in Peter, but he also reveals what Peter's life is going to look like from that point forward. Peter's no longer going to be the strong, independent person that he has been for the first half of his life, but now he's going to be a humble, dependent servant. It says, Jesus says to Peter, "Truly, truly, I say to you, when you were young, you used to dress yourself and walk wherever you wanted. But when you are old, you will stretch out your hands, and another will dress you and carry you where you do not want to go." Throughout the gospel, we've seen this energetic, enthusiastic, strong, determined Peter. Even in this particular story, he's the one who jumps into the water after he puts his cloak on. He's the one who hauls in the fish. He is a strong, determined follower of Jesus. But Jesus says that the second half of his life, other people are going to dress him, and other people are going to make him go where he does not want to go. That after a lifetime of feeding Jesus' sheep, Peter is going to die a death that glorifies God. Church history tells us that Peter, like Jesus, was crucified. But Peter felt like being crucified like Jesus, he was not worthy of that. And so he insisted on being crucified upside down. This is the new, humble Peter, transformed by Jesus' service of him. We too, as we experience Jesus and his gifts to us, graciously walking with us, providing for us, forgiving us, serving us, we are transformed into humble servants. It's often said that humility is not thinking less of yourself. It is thinking of yourself less. Humility is not thinking less of yourself. It's thinking of yourself less. It's taking the attention off yourself and all of your failures, which we can all so easily come up with, and instead of focusing on others, first focusing on Jesus, receiving his gifts of service, receiving his love and forgiveness of us is what actually humbles us. And as Jesus serves us, we are transformed into people that can go out and serve others. We're not only concerned about our own needs and our own comforts, but are now, because Jesus has shown us what it looks like, are willing to look to the needs and the comforts of others. This is the impact that Jesus has on us. And I hope that as you hear this story, as you hear me explain it, you have a desire to go out and serve Jesus. That's what Jesus' intention for this passage is that you are transformed by his service. But realize that this is a radically different way of living than anyone else has ever described before. It's an impossible way of living because it's so unnatural. It's only by receiving the service of Jesus that we are actually able to do this. We are all tempted to go back and look for our own needs and try to build a name for ourselves rather than living for the glory of Jesus. So even as you are inspired to do that, know that you are going to be easily distracted. We are more distracted now than we have ever been in our lives. I am willing to bet that there have been moments in the few moments that I've been preaching where you've wondered if you should check your email or check the news or get up and get something to drink. It's hard to just sit and focus on one thing, and I get that. And Peter gets that as well. Distraction has always been a problem for us. At some point in this conversation, Jesus and Peter start to make their way down the beach. They are walking together, they're talking. Peter is thinking about this new life that Jesus has described for him and what that means. And he sees a shadow. Someone is walking behind him. It's someone who's been close to him many times. It's the disciple that Jesus loved, the one who wrote this gospel. We know him as John. He and John had just been together in the boat. And he and John were next to each other at the Last Supper. When Jesus said someone was going to betray him, Peter said to John, "Ask Jesus who it is." John was sitting next to Jesus, so he was able to lay his head on Jesus' side and ask him, "Lord, who is it?" And so Peter had a tendency to compare himself to this disciple. When Peter realizes that this disciple is walking behind them, he turns and he looks at him. And then he looks at Jesus and he says to him, "Lord, what about this man? Is he going to live the same kind of life of service that I'm going to live? Is he going to die the same kind of death that I am going to die?" And Jesus redirects his attention back to him. Jesus says to him, "If it is my will that he remain until I come, What is that to you? And this is the important point. You follow me. He's redirecting Peter's attention back to him. Peter has this tendency to compare himself with others, and so do we. We look at others and we see how well they're doing serving God, and we say, I wish I could serve God like that. We see others and we say, they aren't doing anything for God. At least I'm doing something. Jesus says, what is that to you? Follow me. Focus your attention on me. There are going to be many, the path of following Jesus is going to lead in many different directions. For Peter, it was a life of service and then a horrific death. For John, it was a long, extended life of ministry where he was actually able to write down this gospel. He says, this is the disciple who's bearing witness about these things, who has written these things. And so that was John's path of following Jesus. And it looked different than Peter's path. But Jesus says, no matter where that path leads, just make sure that you're following me. Don't look at the way that others are serving Jesus. Don't look at how well they're doing or how poorly they're doing. But you follow me. Keep redirecting your attention back to my service. I'm the ultimate example for you to follow. And not only am I an example, I'm also the one who is serving you right now and the one who is forgiving and saving you right now. There is no one greater than Jesus. There is no one who knows us better than Jesus, and there is no one who loves us more than Jesus. But Jesus says, on this road of following me, don't get distracted. Keep turning your attention back to me. And as we do, we see this God who is humbly willing to serve his followers so that he can transform his followers into people who humbly serve. Jesus constantly, continually, humbly serves us so that he might transform us into people who humbly serve. John ends his gospel by saying, now there were also many things that Jesus did. Were every one of them to be written, I suppose that the world itself could not contain the books that would be written. This is one book about the works of Jesus. The Gospels tell us about Jesus' life and ministry, his death and resurrection. The rest of the Bible talks about creation. But John tells us in the beginning of his Gospel that Jesus is the one who created the world. And even more than that, Jesus is the one who existed before the creation of the world. If everything Jesus ever did before the beginning of time to the very end of eternity were written down, the world could not contain those books that were written. The point is this: Jesus is continuing to write his story. He's continuing to do these good works. And some of those works that he's doing in your life as well. I want to encourage you that you are part of God's story. If someone were to write these things down and they are being written in heaven, your name is in that story because Jesus is continuing to work. But I also want to remind you that it's not a story about you. This is a story about Jesus. And all of the good works that he does, all of the ways in which he serves us, and it earns our worship and reveals that he is worthy of that worship, it is not so that we can fulfill our own dreams, so that we can make a name for ourselves, but so that we can make a name for Jesus. Jesus will continue to serve us until the end of time, so that we might continue to worship him, be transformed into people who serve others, all for God's glory. Amen.